welcome to Radio Oldie, sponsored by Baillie Gifford Actual Investors. Looking beyond today's headlines, Baillie Gifford backs exceptional companies driving progress and helping investors benefit from long-term growth. Hello, and welcome to Radio Oldie with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie. And I'm delighted to be talking to Robert Harris, the novelist, who has just written a terrific new book, Agrippa, a novel about the Emperor Augustus's right-hand man, who built the Pantheon in Rome and won the Battle of Actium for Augustus. But Robert, the interesting thing about him was that he was a kind of insider-outsider. Would you agree? Is that why you wrote this book about him?
I first came across him when I was writing a novel about Pompeii, nearly 25 years ago, and that novel is all about the great aqueduct, the longest in the world, that fed all the towns on the Bay of Naples. And it's the centre of the book. And it was built by Marcus Agrippa using 30,000 demobbed legionaries after the Battle of Actium. Essentially, these were Mark Antony's soldiers. He had to bring back to Italy. And he built this immense work of engineering in 18 months. And I carried him around in the back of my head then throughout when I was writing the novels about Cicero. Who was this man who was absolutely crucial, and why do we know so little about him? And I thought I would use the traditional means of writing his memoir, really, as a way of giving him a voice.
And you've obviously done very deep research for this, so when you talk about the other things he did, this presumably is true. You hadn't invented this. He repaired the Cloaca Maxima, the greatest sewer in Rome, built 700 wells, 130 reservoirs, 6 bathhouses, 500 drinking fountains, gave 59 days of chariot races in Circus Maximus. This is all true, this?
Yes, yeah. This is from the ancient sources, chiefly Pliny's Natural History. He was like one of those great Victorian engineers. You know, he just built. I mean, not only, therefore, was he a brilliant military commander, but he had a vision, and He really remodeled Rome, and he built the Pantheon, and he built lots of other great buildings. He carried this work over abroad. He built the aqueduct at Cologne, which he founded, in fact, and the aqueduct at Nîmes with its famous bridge, also Agrippa, and he built roads. So, you know, he is a really formidable figure, and he owed everything to his schoolyard friend, Octavius, as he then was, who carried him with him. They met in their early teens, and they were together right until the death of Agrippa at the age of about 50.
And they were born in exactly the same year, it's thought, in 63 BC. It is a slight mystery that they should have been at school together. Here was Augustus, very grand. Agrippa, not so much. You make this jump of suggesting he might have been Julius Caesar's son, which has been suggested before in 1937 by a Professor F.A. Wright. Do you think it probably is true he was Caesar's son?
Well, as I went on, I came to think it more and more likely, chiefly because his origins are so shrouded in mystery. I mean, he was effectively co-ruler of the Roman Empire for many years. He was acknowledged by Augustus as his heir, and at least in the interim, until a member of the Caesar family could take over. He married Caesar's niece, and then eventually his daughter, his only child. He was the kind of stud of the Julio-Claudian dynasty. And anyone who's studied the period knows how many Agrippinas there are littered around. And ultimately, his grandson did become emperor.
Which was unfortunately Caligula.
Yes. But why don't we know anything more about where he came from? That is fascinating. There's some reason for it. There must be. Maybe it was shame at the plebeian origins, or perhaps it was some other secret. At any rate, it's a theory, because where did this genius for military command and organisation come from. I'm not saying everything is hereditary, but it is remarkable that this lightning should have struck on this schoolboy friend of Augustus.
And Caesar did sleep with other men's wives, and he was in the right place at the right time.
Yes.
9 months before.
Yes, he was in Rome. It was the year that Cicero became consul, and Julius Caesar was very active at that time, supporting Catiline. And, it's the dates fit, and we know that he had lots of affairs with the wives of colleagues. So, I mean, it struck me as an interesting thing, because Caesar is obviously a character in the book, along with Augustus.
And it would explain, because you suggest that Augustus himself was this weak, sickly figure who, in fact, suffered from seasickness. That also stacks up, does it?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, really, the seeds of Augustus's success were sown, oddly enough, at sea. I mean, he defeated Sextus Pompeius, the son of Pompey the Great, who had taken over Sicily. History has rather forgotten Sextus Pompey, but he was a very big figure at the time and was a menace. And it was Agrippa that built the new naval base on the Bay of Naples, the Portus Julius, and founded the navy and led it into battle and defeated the Sextus Pompeius. And then, as we mentioned earlier, the Battle of Actium, possibly one of the most, well, not even possibly, actually one of the most decisive battles in the history of the world, which put paid to Mark Antony and Cleopatra and shifted the whole weight of the empire away from Egypt and to Gaul and ultimately to Britain. So, you know, Agrippa is absolutely a crucial figure here.
And even designed a particular sort of ship with a kind of a grappling hook that traps other ships.
Yes, in revolutionary naval tactics, he put sort of collapsible towers on the warships that fired catapults with grappling irons attached to chains, which would go hurtling across the surface of the sea, fix onto the enemy, and then you would haul yourself aboard. I mean, he was... and this we are overlooking, his command on land, which was also formidable, both in the civil wars and in keeping control of Gaul and putting down a rebellion in Spain and going into the Balkans. You know, he was indefatigable. He lived 20 lives, really. And yet he left behind no letter, no speech, virtually no recorded words at all.
And why do you think that is? It's quite extraordinary, isn't it?
It is. Partly because I think he was a man of few words, more of a man of action, but also against all expectations. Everyone thought, and very often he seemed on the brink of death, everyone thought that Augustus would die young. In fact, he lived to 75. He outlived Agrippa by 25 years. And during that time, deliberately or for whatever reason, we don't know, Agrippa's name faded, and the great testament to posterity that Augustus left behind, which runs in the English translation to 3,500 words, is a completely bombastic first person. I swept the seas of pirates, I built these aqueducts, I defeated Mark Antony and Cleopatra. And only twice does the name Agrippa even crop up, let alone there's certainly no credit given to him whatsoever. So I think that you know, the boss wanted to take all the credit. There's something almost Stalinist in the way that he disappeared.
Or in fact, I don't know if you're consciously doing this, there seemed to be elements of Trump in Augustus. Mm. Was that conscious in your mind?
Yes, I don't want to... I never really want to write these novels as sort of patterns, you know, strict allegories, because it's a disservice to history. I think we're living in an era of hugely rich oligarchs, and that was certainly how the Roman Empire was won. The crucial thing about Augustus, who I don't think was personally a particularly likable man at all, but he was the most ruthlessly effective politician, crafty and cunning, and he altered the course of world history. And Agrippa was not that. He was the opposite. They needed one another. Agrippa wouldn't have risen anywhere without his friendship with Augustus. Equally, Augustus would have found it very difficult to prevail because he was often too sick to lead his men into battle. He wasn't really a warrior type. He was an administrator and a very effective politician.
And very good at his PR. I didn't realise this, but that the famous statues you see of Augustus, 10,000 of them across the empire, always comes across as an extremely good-looking young man, but that actually is modelled on an equestrian son.
This is an invention of mine.
Right.
What we do know from all the sources is that Augustus, certainly as he got older, was stoop-shouldered, bad teeth, you know, not a heroic-looking figure at all. But the careful propaganda imagery that went out of Augustus was of a kind of a youthful Apollo. There was a standard, rather like the king's head on the stamps. You know, there is an idealised view of Augustus, which was very useful for controlling this vast, disparate empire all around the Mediterranean. He couldn't be there in person, but you could have your statue of him in a town square. And, of course, it looked very heroic.
And the famous line about Augustus, which is in Suetonius, Augustus declared, "I found Rome a city of bricks and left it a city of marble," which I think is in the Res Gesta, isn't it? That is basically what Agrippa did, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, Agrippa is the master builder. I don't think that obviously he didn't undertake all this work on it just entirely on his own account. He did it for the regime. He certainly paid for a lot of it. He became immensely wealthy, as, of course, did Augustus. These men would take the wealth of whole countries and use it personally. After Agrippa secured Spain for Augustus, in the first year, took 7 tons of gold from the mines in Spain. You know, they were immensely wealthy. So certainly, you know, Augustus was involved in all of this, but the person who actually seems to have done it, in particular the aqueducts and the development on the field of Mars, was Agrippa.
And you're very good at explaining the really complicated build-up to Augustus becoming emperor, because it's quite a precarious thing. We've talked about the Battle of Actium, but it's not a foregone conclusion that he'll be number one, and obviously he's the first one to become emperor, but it's quite a precarious thing, isn't it, for him to become emperor?
Yes. You know, the civil wars in Rome had been going on for donkey's years, so there was no expectation particularly that it would settle down and this man would rule for the best part of 40 years. That took an immense amount of cunning and ruthlessness. One of the parallels with today, which I do find interesting, and the genius of Augustus, was that he kept the facade of the old republic. So you had the Senate, you had elections on the field of Mars, people stood for the consulship and so on. Still a lot of the provinces went to senators, but he kept control of the provinces where the army was, so he had control of the army. Really no one could get into a senior position without his say-so. It's a bit like Putin or someone, you know, there are elections, but who are we kidding here? We always know who's going to win.
Yeah.
And Augustus was one of the first, he was a sort of modern totalitarian ruler, really interfering in all aspects of life as well. Public morality, private morality, this was something he was very keen on, even though he himself was notorious for immorality, chiefly with the wives of his officers. So they're a real study in contrast, these two men. And I was a political journalist. I'm interested in the relationship between people and power. And Agrippa is often portrayed as just a simple, utterly loyal yes man. We know actually that wasn't quite the case. They certainly had a falling out at one point. And I just try to imagine what it would have felt like to be Agrippa, to be this successful and powerful, and yet never to have a triumph. Even the great battles of defeating the pirates in Actium, he never was awarded a triumph. To be sort of the stud of the families. And he produced 2 male heirs with Julia, the daughter of Augustus, and Augustus insisted on adopting them. They became his sons, not Agrippa's, legally. And I imagine that that must be, for any man, a heck of a blow. So, you know, they were bound together.
And stole the credit for military victories yeah. and for rebuilding Rome.
They were bound together. Each couldn't survive without the other. I don't think it ever really seriously crossed Agrippa's mind to try and seize power, even though he was the man who really the legions looked to for leadership. Nevertheless, and this is again quite modern, isn't it? It's about branding, to put it crudely. Caesar had the name, even though he was only the great nephew of Caesar, and the female line at that. Nevertheless, it was enough to have the name Caesar and to have been named in Caesar's will for thousands of veterans to turn out and follow him. And Agrippa knew that he would never have that. And there's no way that Rome would have accepted having a plebeian of unknown, obscure origins presiding over all these ancient patrician families.
And do you think you've now written, as you said, about Pompey and about Cicero? It's a remarkable time. It seems extraordinary that this great dynasty goes on when so many of them are monsters or hopeless, but it's partly that love of a dynasty that keeps it going
yes.
for 400 years or
and,
so.
And look at America, the Kennedys, the Bushes, maybe even, God help us, the Trumps. You know, the name is just a huge shortcut to power. And it brings with it all the advisors from previous administrations and so on. And this really is what was established in Rome. Of course, the whole idea of the Republic was to prevent the emergence of a king, but to divide power between two consuls who could was strictly limited to 1 year in office. But that whole rule was smashed by Julius Caesar, and it was never put back together.
Well, and it applies to our own royal family as well, which is kind of remarkably successful, its continuity, isn't it? Do you think that we've just watched Abby Burnham being anointed as the new Prime Minister, you as a former political correspondent, are you astonished by this sudden rush of Prime Ministers?
Not especially, no. We're living in a time of enormous political, economic, technological upheaval, and in the past we've often had lots of prime ministers during those particular times, and in a sense the system worked. I mean, it was clear that Keir Starmer had lost the confidence of his cabinet and a lot of his parliamentary party, and rather brilliantly he was returned, Burnham, in an election, in a by-election, and came in and does have the support of the vast majority of the Labour Party in Parliament. So, you know, our system has worked, and the king, the monarchy, provides this kind of a brand, if you like, that separates the country from politics. When I was younger, I was a Republican, but as time has gone on, I've changed my view because I've come to see that human beings and politics are irrational, and it's useless to try and put in rigid laws. Of course, you know, looked at it coldly, it's absurd that we should have this system, but it works, and I think a lot of us are grateful that through all the turmoil of the last 10 years or more, that there was first Queen Elizabeth and now King Charles, that they do represent a kind of stability, a sheet anchor for the country, regardless of their personal foibles or whatever. There they are.
And to return to Augustus, there is this remarkable period which you're writing about, that as well as having Augustus becoming emperor, there are his kind of pet writers on the scene who you refer to, Virgil and Horace and the great tycoon Maecenas. Can you explain why there was this kind of remarkable flowering in this particular period?
Well, I think it's often one of the periods of huge upheaval often do produce art. And it was the Golden Age, and Augustus was a great patron of the arts. And it was part of the whole regime image building that not only did he have the heroic statues of himself and build these enormous buildings, these great marble halls, which of course have been aped by the Americans since. He encouraged the arts, and Virgil was practically the sort of poet laureate of the Augustan age. It was a moment that I really enjoyed writing the novel, because Agrippa, I don't think, took much of an interest in all of this. And he goes to a dinner at Maecenas and has to listen to these two poets reciting after the meal. One is all about agriculture, and the other is so filthy, it's even worse than anything he's heard in the army camp.
Is it the Georgics?
Virgil's Georgics, yeah. And then, yes, and then Horace. So, yeah, I mean... But it was an extraordinary time, and I really did enjoy writing the book. It was a voyage of exploration for me and discovery as I went on, and it's quite thrilling to feel. I mean, in a sense, no word of the book is true, because he never wrote a memoir, and I don't know what he was like, but it could have been something like that, like this, and it was a pleasure to do.
And out of thought, it's particularly pleasurable to write about that period, because there is quite a lot of documentation and literature about it, but it's long enough ago, there's enough that isn't known that you can conjecture and you won't be wrong.
Yes, I mean, it's almost a perfect situation for a historical novelist to have someone whose public deeds are recorded and there to see, but we know nothing about his interior life. So that gives me a lot of room to manoeuvre, and in a way it's a justification for historical fiction. I mean, this book could not have been written by a scholar. It would be impossible to do it. But it's something a novelist can do, and that's what I try to do. And also, the civil wars are incredibly complicated. You know, the crossing of the Rubicon is only the start.
Which we've explained to our listeners what it is. Everyone knows what the expression means, but they don't know what actually happened.
Well, the Caesar crossed the Rubicon in 49.
Which is the river, I think, in the kind of northeast of Italy.
Yes, and it was the dividing line between Italy and Gaul. And he wasn't allowed to bring an army into Italy, but he did. He brought his legions from Gaul, in particular the famous 13th Legion, and marched on Rome. And that began a period of really just immense upheaval. And every time it seemed to stop, it flared up again. And by taking the character of Agrippa and having him side by side with Octavius, later Augustus, you can sort of see how it all happened, because it becomes a narrative, and these immense characters are thrown up: Mark Antony, and Maecenas, and Fulvia,
Cleopatra,
Livia, the most formidable political brain, married to Augustus. It was, these big figures can now put them in the story and can see how they acted and reacted to one another.
Well, that's a very good place to stop. And thank you so much to Robert Harris for talking about his brilliant new novel, Agrippa.
Thanks, Harry. I enjoyed it.
This week's podcast was kindly sponsored by Baillie Gifford Actual Investors, who take a long-term approach to investing in exceptional companies.